I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Today, we'll talk with Maryland Congresswoman Donna Edwards. She's one of seven Democrats running for the party's nomination to fill the U.S. Senate seat of Barbara Mikulski, who's retiring in 2017. Edwards was elected to Congress in 2008. She represents parts of Prince George's and Anne Arundel counties. Political analysts of the Senate race describe Edwards as a progressive running against a far better funded, more establishment insider. How does she see it? Plus, all six police officers charged in the Freddie Gray case were in court this morning. We'll get the latest. But first, an interview with Congresswoman Donna Edwards on Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us. Later in the hour, we'll catch up with WIPR news reporter P. Kenneth Burns, who's been covering the Freddie Gray legal proceedings. All six officers charged in the case were in court this morning. But first, we welcome Maryland Congresswoman Donna Edwards to our studio. She's one of seven candidates who's filed to run for the Democratic nomination to fill the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Barbara Mikulski. The primary will be held next April. 7 months ago, Senator Mikulski announced she'd retire when her current term ends in 2017. And immediately, Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen from Montgomery County announced he would run for the seat, and Donna Edwards from Prince George's County quickly followed. Van Hollen is the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee, has received support from some ranking Democrats. They are the two big names in the field. Chris Van Hollen and Donna Edwards. There are five other Democrats running, according to the Maryland Board of Elections. Donna Edwards co-founded the National Network to End Domestic Violence. She was one of the advocates who helped pass the Violence Against Women Act of 1994. She has served in the U.S. House of Representatives since June 2008. She's the first African-American woman to hold a congressional seat from Maryland. Her congressional district includes parts of Prince George's and Anne Arundel counties. Donna Edwards was born in tiny Yanceyville, North Carolina, but moved around a lot when she was young because her father served in the Air Force. She has a law degree from the University of New Hampshire. She's lived in Fort Washington in southern Prince George's for three decades. Congressman Donna Edwards, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you. It's great to be here, especially in studio.
It's great to have you here in studio. It's nice to be able to look at you. Last week, you read the names of Marylanders who have lost their lives to gun violence on the House floor. Talk about that issue of gun violence in your campaign.
Well, you know, I mean, it's been very frustrating, frankly, as a member of the House of Representatives, that every time there's some mass shooting that takes place, such as the one that took place on the community college campus in Oregon, we take to the floor of the House and offer up a moment of silence. But we don't do anything, and there's no action. And I think while, you know, the focus can be on the mass shootings, every day in this country, almost 92 Americans lose their lives to gun violence. And here in Maryland, over 300 people have lost their lives to gun violence in our state just in this part of the year only, and we haven't even finished out the year. And I thought it was important to call attention to the one and two and three at a time deaths that occur for gun violence. And, you know, we have to do something about that. We have to, you know, strengthen the background check system. We have to make sure that guns aren't getting into the hands of domestic abusers, people with mental illness, and who present a danger to themselves and others. And there are things that we can actually do. And I think it's time for us to honor the lives of those who've been lost, who are mothers and fathers and sisters and sons and daughters. And, you know, I feel really strongly about that. And although I wouldn't say...
How do you take on the NRA? It seems like a stalled issue.
I think we have to take on the National Rifle Association directly, and by calling them out. The National Rifle Association only represents the interest of gun manufacturers, not responsible gun owners, not people who are hunters and shooters, who are gamesmen. They represent an industry that's only interested in making a profit, an industry that has opposed background checks, an industry that opposes us, you know, being able to apply the same rules to a gun show as we do to a retail sale, an industry that continues to oppose every single bit of common sense, gun legislation that most Americans actually agree with. And so we have to stand them down. They give away political contributions. They stand in the way of our politics, and it's time to stand in their way.
But this seems to be an issue on which each side is preaching to their own choir. How do you change the balance?
I don't think that's true. I think if you look at poll after poll, Americans, the majority of Americans believe that we need a background system check that works. Americans in poll after poll believe that we could have technology that makes sure that accidents don't happen with guns. A majority of Americans believe that if you are prohibited from purchasing a weapon because you're a domestic abuser in a retail establishment, that you shouldn't be allowed to go to a parking lot or a gun show and buy that same gun. And so I'm not talking about anything extraordinary or anything that gets in the way of people's Second Amendment rights. I'm talking about what a majority of Americans believe, and it's time for us in the Congress to eschew the National Rifle Association. Look, I did it before. In 1996, I was one of those who helped pass the domestic violence offender gun ban, and the NRA came after us full bore, and we stood them down. We survived a constitutional challenge in the courts, and that remains on the books today. But the loophole is that somebody who's prohibited from getting a gun as a domestic abuser can go to a gun show or can go to a parking lot or go on the internet and still buy that gun. That's wrong.
That's Congresswoman Donna Edwards, candidate for U.S. Senate here on Midday. And you can be part of this conversation. What questions do you have for Donna Edwards, who's running as a Democrat to follow Barbara Mikulski in the U.S. Senate? Call us, 410-662-8780. If it's long distance, we have that covered too. You can call 1-866-661-9209. That's toll free. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd love for you to be part of this conversation. I want to talk about your campaign. Why did you decide to run for the Senate?
Well, you know, I've represented Maryland in the House of Representatives since 2008. I came in a special election. I never believed it should be, something that I should do until forever. And when Senator Mikulski announced her retirement, I was surprised, like everybody else was surprised. And I took some stock of that. I looked at what we needed. And I decided in consultation with a lot of people from around the state that it was really important for me to throw my hat in the ring to represent the voices of ordinary working people who get up in the morning, want to go to a decent job, get paid a decent wage, maybe take a vacation day occasionally or a day off sick, and that those interests in terms of being represented are missing in the United States Senate. And I have both the life experience and the work experience to really bring the issues that concern working people every day to the Senate. How do we create jobs up and down the income stream so that people who want to work can go to work and be paid a decent wage? How do we make sure that our children have the advantage of an education that works for them no matter what zip code they live in, that they're able to tackle those jobs that are coming up in the 21st century? And these are important issues for me. Look, I grew up in a middle-class family. My dad was in the United States Air Force for almost 30 years. I went to almost 14 schools living everywhere as I was growing up. And we settled here in Maryland because Maryland is a really great state. But we also have some real pockets of need. We have them in our greatest city, Baltimore. We have them in Prince George's County. We have those needs all across the state. And I believe it's important to have the voice of a working mom in the United States Senate who reflects the interests, the viewpoints, and the values of the people of our state.
How important is it to have an African-American voice in the U.S. Senate? And how important is that in your campaign?
I think it's particularly important to have an African-American woman's voice in the United States Senate. We have 100 senators. 20 of them are women. We're losing one in Barbara Mikulski. We have one woman of color, Mazie Hirono, who's from Hawaii. And there hasn't been an African-American woman serving in the Senate since the 1990s with Carol Moseley Braun. And she's the only one in our 239 your history. Look at my experience. I'm a lawyer. I was a systems engineer working in the space program for a time. I ran nonprofit organizations. I bring a breadth of experience to the United States Senate, but I also bring a life experience that's a unique perspective that would come to the Senate. As a single mom, I've raised my son on my own largely for since he was 3 years old. He's 27 now and doing quite well. And I think the voice of a mom who knows what it's like, an African-American mom who knows what it's like to have that conversation with her son as he's growing older and going out about what he could encounter on the streets, is an important voice as we try to figure out how we strengthen our cities, how we build our communities, how we make sure that we have opportunity for every young child, no matter where they live, no matter what their zip code, no matter what their color. And I think that I bring that unique perspective into the Senate. As a woman, I bring that perspective. Nobody else can tell me what it means to work for unequal pay, for equal work, because I've lived that. I can share that story myself. I don't need a substitute voice. And I think that that's what working people around Maryland are saying, is that we want a voice that represents our values, our ideals, and where we've come from, who understands what it means to put a paycheck together to balance the rent and the mortgage and, you know, student loan debt and hospital payments and all of the things that people do. And that is a voice, frankly, that is very missing from the United States Senate.
We have some voices, some Maryland voices who want to be part of this conversation, who called us at 410-662-8780, which you can do, too. Let's go to Dave in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday, Dave.
Thank you, and congratulations on the hosting that you've taken over. It's really refreshing. I have a question for Ms. Edwards. I want to congratulate her for her gun position so far. And I don't think it's a stalled movement, that it's growing like auto safety, tobacco, there's a lot can be done. But in Maryland particularly, and the media could help here, where are the bad guns coming from into Baltimore, into D.C.? They can't all come from Virginia. I mean, the stores that would think, have you thought that through, what possibly could be done to trace?
It's a good question, Dave. Let me see what Congressman Edwards has to say about it.
Unfortunately, a lot of the guns that are being used in criminal activity are coming from Maryland. And so it's telling us that...
Being manufactured in Maryland?
No, not being manufactured, but being purchased in our state. It's not as though all
But
of
I
our...
think Dave is asking, what's the pipeline? Do we know how they get here?
We know that the gun manufacturers who operate all across this country are selling guns, but the guns that are used in illegal activity, the guns that we want to get a handle on, are coming, you know, through various sources, but they are coming from Maryland purchases, whether those are purchases on the street, purchases in gun shops, purchases because we don't have an effective background check system so that we know who's actually purchasing the weapon. I mean, even the National Rifle Association has stood in the way of having an effective background check system so that I know that if you've committed a crime either in some other county in Maryland or in another state, that that's in a registry so that when you go to purchase a weapon, you're not allowed to do it. Standing in the way, for example, of, you know, as I said, a domestic violence purchaser. We're here in Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Most women who are losing their lives in domestic violence incidences are losing their lives as a result of gun violence. And so those are weapons that should not be in the hands of people who have a history of domestic violence or domestic violence offenses. So I think that there is, I agree with Dave, that there is something that we can do about this, that we have to stand, really tall against the National Rifle Association. And more importantly, we have to say to our legislators, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to stand up to them. And let's pass sensible gun regulation that's going to result in getting these guns off of the streets.
Dave, thanks for your call. There is another David calling us from Salisbury, Maryland, a firearm safety instructor, right, David?
That's right. Good morning. David Cook here. I'm a Maryland State Police qualified handgun instructor, NRA pistol instructor, NRA personal protection inside the home instructor. I know all about Maryland law. In order to purchase a firearm in Maryland, you must have an HQL. That's a handgun qualification license. I teach the class to obtain that license. You have to get your fingerprints. You have to get a background check in order to purchase a firearm. You fill out a State Police 77R, and you also have your fingerprints submitted to the FBI. So where I disagree is the NRA isn't necessarily blocking everything that we're all trying to do here. Actually, being an instructor, I'm out on the streets instructing these people, and I serve as another layer between the gun buyer and the state police to figure out who ought to be buying guns and who ought not to. So in order to purchase a firearm legally in Maryland, everything's in place. The things that aren't in place are preventing the illegal purchase of firearms, and that is where I think we need to concentrate our efforts. Everything else is in place. It's with the buying them out of the trunk of cars, buying them on the street. That's where the problem is. It doesn't come from we people that are legal.
David, it's not clear to me. Do you have a particular question that you want Congressman Edwards to address?
I want to present the other side so the congressman can discuss it.
Okay, let her get a word in.
Well, David, I mean, you have really hit the nail on the head. This is the point that responsible gun owners are doing exactly what you said, and people who are purchasing weapons legally are doing exactly what you said, and that's what we want. And it's the reason that even a majority of NRA members believe that we should have sensible regulation to make sure that we have a background check system that actually works from Maryland to Virginia to California, all across the country, that we have one system where everyone is reporting, where, you know, the person who's prohibited from purchasing a weapon in Virginia doesn't get to go to Maryland and purchase a weapon. And so I really do agree with David, and I think he's doing exactly the right thing. There are millions of responsible gun owners out there who are being maligned precisely because there are others who stand with the interest of the gun manufacturers in place of passing sensible gun regulations so that responsible gun owners can make sure that they are able to continue in an environment that only requires us to pass sensible regulation. And so I actually agree with David that he's doing all the right things, and that we need to make sure that we curtail the purchase of illegal weapons out of the trunk in a parking lot, people who would legally be prohibited from purchasing a weapon.
David, I appreciate your calling. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Democratic Congressman Donna Edwards, who's running to fill the seat of retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski, the U.S. Senate seat. We welcome your calls. You can call us at 410-662-8780 with your question for Donna Edwards. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm here with Democratic Congressman Donna Edwards, who is running for the U.S. Senate seat that Barbara Mikulski will vacate in 2017. The primary is next April. You can be part of this conversation. We'd like you to be. Call us at 410-662-8780 with your question for Congresswoman Donna Edwards, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So far, there are 7 Democrats running to replace Senator Mikulski. More may yet get in. But at least for now, this is seen very much as a race between you and Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Montgomery County. The June 30th reports to the Federal Elections Commission showed Van Hollen had outraised your campaign by almost 4-1. He's already started airing television commercials in the Baltimore market. How do you compete with that?
Well, you know, first of all, I think it's really important for people to know that I'm a strong progressive fighter. When I first ran for Congress in 2008 and won my election, then defeating a longtime Democratic incumbent who was backed by all of the party establishment, much like the race that we're facing right now, that I did it by going out and reaching out and touching voters in my congressional district. I'm reaching out and touching voters all across our great state of Maryland, communicating with them am about the kind of progressive fighter and leader that I'm going to be. One who's willing to stand up even to our Democratic Party establishment when they're doing the wrong thing, because I understand how people live their lives. And I think that that's what Maryland voters want. They want somebody who's going to represent their interest and not the interest of Wall Street banks, not the interest of special interests, not creating loopholes for the National Rifle Association, as my principal opponent has done. And I think that those are going to be strong keys to making sure that message and people-powered politics win over money. And I know that we're going to do that in this race, and we're going to do it reaching out and touching voters all across our state.
Okay, before we leave the question of money, new numbers are expected from the FEC, I think, this week. Is it going to show a difference, or will you continue to be the underdog in money?
Well, I think clearly Mr. Van Hollen, you know, raises money from all of the interests that you can name. And so I expect that that is going to be true. But we're going to raise enough money to run a race here in Maryland that's a strong one all across our state. And the fact is that up until now, even though I've been outraised, I'm ahead in the latest poll that was released, 5 points ahead, in fact.
This is an internal poll.
It was an internal poll, but totally, legit poll done by, a polling firm that runs Senate campaigns all across the country. And so I feel very confident about that. And frankly, I think that if anybody else had a competing poll or something that showed anything different, they'd release it. So if Mr. Van Hollen has a poll that he's done that shows that he's ahead, I'd welcome him to release that. But we know that we're ahead in this race. We know that we can win in this race. But this isn't about competing for dollars. It's about asking voters to stand up and take their place in the United States Senate with a progressive fighter who's going to look out for their jobs, create opportunity, and making sure that, you know, we protect the interest of our seniors with Social Security and Medicare. I mean, I've stood on behalf of our seniors, on behalf of working people, and I will continue to do that in the United States Senate.
I want to pick up on, you used the phrase a minute ago, special interest money that he's raising. He argues that three-fourths of the money he's raised is from in-state, a much bigger percentage than your fundraising, because you're getting a lot of money from out of state. He has called for you both to sign a pledge not to take super PAC money, for example. Your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I can't take super PAC money, but Mr. Van Hollen was the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and he welcomed super PAC money in those campaigns that he ran and he spent money on. I think, you know, if you look at my donors, we have thousands and thousands of donors who are small donors. Mr. Van Hollen is talking about those, you know, large donors over, you know, $2,700. A lot of our donors, frankly, our average donation is actually under $50. And so I feel very confident that we are running a campaign that's about people and not about money and special interests. Even just last week, I think Mr. Van Hollen had a fundraiser that was hosted by a guy who tried to undo the Dodd-Frank regulations. And so I know that I'm very clearly on the side of people. I understand what it means to get up every day and work for a living and take care of a son and pay my bills. And I think that those are values that need to be reflected in the United States Senate. Those are values that I'll reflect in the Senate. And that's how, you know, when I first came into Congress, Sheila, the very first piece of legislation that I ever worked on was getting young people, students in our schools who receive free and reduced breakfast and lunch, supper. Something really simple, something that any member of Congress, including Chris Van Hollen, could have done in the time that they served. And it wasn't until I came into Congress and did that. Those are the kind of things that are called getting things done for people and making sure that our young people had the food that they need to just go to school and learn. And that is the kind of campaign that we're running, one that's not at a 30,000-foot level, that's right on the ground, that's right there, making sure that the people of the state of Maryland know that I'm going to continue to build on that legacy, that strong legacy that Barbara Mikulski has had of fighting for working people, fighting for our families, fighting to make Maryland strong.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Donna Edwards running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate here on Midday on WYPR. She's going to be with us just a few more minutes, so if you have a question for her, this is the time to call 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Mike is calling us from Carroll County. Welcome to Midday, Mike.
Yes. Hi. My question was about the gun control and how you said you were going to keep it out of the hands of mental ill people. That's kind of like a vague swath of people, though. Is there a specific way you're going to do that, or is it just, you know, anybody that's taking, you know, depression medicine or something?
No, and let's be clear, Mike. I mean, most people who are mentally ill are not engaged in mass shootings and killings. It's just that is one of the prohibitions under the law currently, is somebody who has actually been diagnosed with a mental illness and determined to be a danger to himself or others. And so it's actually a very narrow category. The point is that when we already have a law in place that prohibits weapons from being purchased or possessed by a certain category of people, whether they're felons or domestic abusers or people with a diagnosed mental illness, as I've described, then we should have a system that works to effectively make sure that those names are in a registry so that they can't purchase or possess those weapons. You know, I come from a family in which one of my brother, who's no longer with us, was diagnosed with a mental illness. He was not a danger to himself or to others, and so he wouldn't have fallen in that category. But I think that we should have sensible legislation around gun safety that makes sure that we do the things that we need to do to prevent my having to read another 301 names of Marylanders who've lost their lives to gun violence.
Do you think mental health is a big factor in most of those 300 deaths?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact. I mean, I think it's also true that, you know, we have violence that's going on in our streets, and we need to address that. I think we can address that in a number of ways that actually have to do with how we create jobs and opportunity in our communities where it's most needed, how we make sure that we strengthen our education system. So there are a lot of factors around violence. But one thing that we do know is that we can create sensible legislation that makes sure that we do what we can. We may not be able to fix everything, but let's do what we can to reduce those deaths by gun violence, and do that in a way that protects constitutional interests, but also makes sure that we take guns out of the hands of people who should not have them and who could do great harm to others. I think that we have a lot of work to do, Sheila, in making sure that we strengthen Maryland and strengthen our countries. And we have to start by growing an economy that works for all of us. We have to do that by making sure that we have an education that works for people no matter what zip code they live in.
Mike, thanks for your call. Let's go to Eric from Baltimore, who I think wants to pick up on what you were saying about jobs. Eric, welcome to Midday.
Hello, Sheila. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Congresswoman Edwards if she would support some sort of legislation that would honor the principle of equal pay for equal work in higher education. I am an adjunct professor. I'm teaching 6 college courses this semester at 2 public institutions in Maryland. I live in Baltimore City. I have 4 children in the city school system. And I'm going to earn about $16,000 for teaching those 6 courses. I'll be reading about 1,000 essays this semester. And by the end of the year, I will have earned, for teaching 10 college courses throughout the year, including the summer. And that's, by the way, that's more than a full-time load for a regular faculty member. I will have earned about $27,000. I receive no benefits whatsoever. And my students pay the same price to take my courses. They earn the same credit. They have every right to expect the same from me that they do from regular faculty. And by all accounts, my teaching having been commended, they get it. And
so,
I'm wondering when I can expect something like something other than the really iniquitous inequity that that defines college education all across the country.
So Eric is an adjunct professor, I assume, and is this something that you can see government should get into? He works for public institutions. Is this a matter that should be negotiated by the adjuncts, or is this something that there should be law?
Well, I've actually been greatly supportive of a growing movement around the country of organizing for the purposes of collective bargaining of adjunct professors. We've seen that happen in the District of Columbia and some of the universities there, in both public and private institutions around the country. And I think there's a strong case to be made that by organizing and giving collective bargaining access to adjunct professors, people like our caller actually will see their work rewarded in a more meaningful way. I mean, it raises the issue of, you know, where we are. I mean, we've seen stagnant wages across a number of different sectors, a move toward privatization of ordinary public work, and wages that have flatlined for a couple of decades. And to me, it raises a question of the need for greater collective bargaining rights among workers across the country so that we can strengthen their own pocketbooks, grow jobs by making sure that people are rewarded for the work that they do, they receive decent benefits, and as I say, just, you know, a lousy day off in case somebody gets sick in their family. And I think what the caller has described is one that begs for a collective bargaining union organizing within the adjunct professor environment.
Eric, thanks for your call. I wanted to ask you about endorsements. Both you and Chris Van Hollen have lots of endorsements. You've both gotten various union endorsements. You've been endorsed by Emily's List, which is the progressive group that particularly supports women running for public office. But there's another endorsement that got a lot of attention recently, and that was when Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker endorsed Chris Van Hollen. This is your county executive in your home county, and people said, what's that about?
Well, you know, I mean, I can't explain that endorsement, but what I can say to you is I've also been endorsed by a majority of the county council, people who are on the ground in community in Prince George's County, because they know how closely I've worked with them. Across the board, we've seen election after election, especially among Democrats, where the Democrat racks up every single endorsement and then doesn't win a vote. And so the endorsement that I'm most interested in, although I love my endorsements and, you know, the supportive people I've gotten, the endorsement I'm most interested in is the endorsement of voters. We clearly have that in the strong showing that we've had in the public opinion polls that have been done thus far. And so I feel absolutely confident that both here in Baltimore and around our state, that I will see really strong endorsements, and particularly from unions. That means a lot to me when working people endorse me, the Teamsters, the electrical workers, the machinists, the bricklayers who've endorsed me. It means a lot to me that working people are endorsing this campaign that's about people and not just about politics and money. And so does it surprise me at all that the political establishment is supporting the establishment candidate? Not so much. I'm more interested in the support of people.
We had a call. A caller is no longer with us. I think it was Tyler. He was from Frederick County, but he was raising an issue that is important in Baltimore. And Baltimoreans might be feeling a little left out of this race since the two big contenders are from the Washington suburbs. And that was about transportation. What is your answer for transportation in Frederick and Baltimore? How should Maryland's transportation be improved?
Well, transportation grows jobs and grows the economy, whether it's in Maryland or across the country. And I think it's been an abject failure of the Republicans in Congress not to bring forward transportation infrastructure legislation that would authorize transportation projects all across this country. I was particularly disappointed that the governor has decided to nix the red line. I think it's a huge mistake because the red line, not only are you giving away $900 million in federal money back to some other state because it's not going to stay here in Maryland, but you're preventing people from getting from one job to from their home to a job, and you're preventing economic development when you get in the way of transportation. And so I very strongly support a robust investment in our transportation and all of our infrastructure, because it is the way that we're going to grow our economy for this century. And if transportation is not going to work in Baltimore, if transportation is not going to work in the metropolitan Washington region, then Maryland is going to be in a very poor position when it comes to competing for jobs and opportunity. And I would say, you know, if you look at the roads and the bridges across the state, particularly in Western Maryland on the Eastern Shore, we need a robust investment in our transportation infrastructure. And that is true all across the state.
Congressman Donna Edwards, I really appreciate your spending some time with us, taking some time from the campaign trail to be with us. Thank you.
Thank you. I look forward to visiting you again.
I hope you can. I hope you can. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to catch up on today's court arguments in the Freddie Gray trial. So stay with us for that. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and we're going to take this minute now to catch up with P. Kenneth Burns, WIPR news reporter who's been covering the Freddie Gray proceedings for us. He's joining us on the line from Courthouse to East downtown, where the arguments have been recessed until 2 o'clock. Kenny, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sheila.
So, tell me what was before Judge Barry Williams in today's arguments. It had to do with statements that the police officers had made?
Yes. Three of the police officers, Officer Nero, Officer Miller, and Officer Rice, they were seeking to have their statements taken out of play for the trial. They decided not to pursue those motions today for the time being. So the majority of the morning was spent discussing whether or not Sergeant Alicia White's statements would be admitted. Now, these are the statements made during two interviews, one on April the 12th and one on April the 17th.
And the defense was arguing what in relation to Sergeant White's statements? Why was the defense saying that they should be suppressed?
The defense was saying that Sergeant White was brought in under not the right circumstances. They said she was a witness when she was interviewed by the now former force investigative team, which has since been renamed by interim police commissioner Kevin Davis. In the first interview, she was brought down as a witness. And in the second interview, she was advised of her rights, her Miranda rights, and her rights as a law enforcement officer, or the LEOBR that we've talked about a lot this year. And the defense was, and the defense argued that she was giving the statement as a witness, not as a suspect.
Okay, and the prosecution's response to those arguments?
Simply put, she knew what her rights were. She was advised of her rights in the second interview, and particularly prosecutor Janice Bledsoe, who argued the case on behalf of the state, said it was incredulous that White did not know what her rights were during the second interview.
So Judge Barry Williams ruled on this and said what?
He did. Yes, the judge ruled that both statements are admissible or they could be used in the upcoming trials. He ruled that if it was, she did not have to be Mirandized or she did not have to have her rights advised during the first interview.
Okay, so all of the officers gave statements. Three of them are no longer arguing over whether or not to allow those statements to be used. The judge has said that Sergeant White's statement can be used, and that leaves Officer William Porter.
Well, slight correction. The only one that did not give a statement is Officer Cesar Goodson. He is facing the most serious charge.
Thank you for correcting me on that. Yes.
But this afternoon, we're expecting that Officer Porter's statement will be the topic of discussion, whether his statements will be admissible or not.
So that is on the agenda for this afternoon.
Yes.
And then there's another argument scheduled for tomorrow. Do we know what that's going to cover?
Other than the more broad category of more pretrial business, we don't know specifically what is going to be discussed tomorrow. But as far as this afternoon, we do have a clue in that the statements of Officer William Porter will be discussed. Now, keep in mind, Officer Porter is the first trial coming up on November the 30th.
Right. So that's a matter of some interest. Kenny, I appreciate your catching us up on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kenneth Burns, WIPR news reporter, who's covering the Freddie Gray trial for us. This is Midday on WIPR 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. I want to turn now to another topic that's going to be front and center at the Enoch Pratt Library on Thursday evening, a discussion about domestic workers and what role they play in the U.S. economy and whether those domestic workers have the rights that they should and are getting the pay that they should. This morning, one of the first things I heard was on Marketplace, Dan Gorenstein reported that today is the first day that healthcare workers will be guaranteed federal labor protections like minimum wage, overtime pay, and travel compensation. And I was especially interested because I knew I was going to have a chance to speak at least briefly with an advocate for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, Asian Poo. She directs the National Domestic Workers Alliance in New York. She spent 20 years advocating for domestic workers. She was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world in 2012 because of this work, and she received a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2014. Ajen Poo is going to be speaking at Wheeler Auditorium in a central branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library Thursday, part of the Open Society Institute's Talking About Race series, and she joins us on the phone now. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So tell me about the significance of these new federal rules.
It's incredibly significant. A lot of people don't know this history, but back in the 1930s, when Congress was debating the New Deal, there were two labor laws that were discussed, the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Act, and they represent the cornerstone of our nation's basic protections for workers. And the Fair Labor Standards Act, in particular, established the right to minimum wage and overtime for all working people in this country. And Southern members of Congress refused to sign on to those two bills if farm workers and domestic workers, who were largely African American at the time, were included. And so in a concession to those members of Congress, those two bills passed and were enacted with the full exclusion of domestic workers and farm workers. And over the generations, advocates have tried to reform and address those exclusions, but there remained an exemption in place, an exclusion of home care workers and companions from basic minimum wage and overtime protection. So before today, if you can imagine, there are many states in this country where it was perfectly legal to pay a home care worker far below minimum wage. And so that legacy of racial exclusion in our labor laws has really shaped the working conditions for domestic workers, home care workers, personal care aides, the people who are charged with caring for the most precious elements of our lives, our aging loved ones and our children. And today, a rule change that the Department of Labor moved forward is finally going into effect that would bring 2 million home care workers who were protected finally under these minimum wage and overtime protections.
So this is a rule. This is an executive branch action. It might not extend past the Obama administration. Is that accurate? It's not in law?
Well, it's not a change in the law, but it is a change in the way the regulations and the regulations are written. So essentially, there was a companionship exemption that was put into place in the 1970s when they were reforming the Fair Labor Standards Act. And this exemption maintained that home care workers and companions for the elderly and the infirmed, people with disabilities, would still be exempted from minimum wage and overtime. And what the Department of Labor did was they essentially updated the definition of companion to make sure that people who are working full-time as personal care aides and home care workers and caregivers, for whom caregiving is a profession, would actually not be covered under the definition of companion. So it gets into the weeds a little bit around policy, but they have not changed law. They've basically changed a definition that applies to how the rule is enforced and the regulations around the enforcement.
So we're talking about caregivers, including elder caregivers, also child care workers, nannies?
No. This rule change applies to elder care providers and personal care aides for people with disabilities.
I see. And how big a workforce are we talking about here?
Well, we have today over 3 million direct care workers and about 3 million, just under 3 million home care workers.
So can you quickly tell me the difference between direct care and home
care? Sure. Direct care workers are the workforce that we count on to care for the aging and people with disabilities in a range of facilities and also in the home setting. So that's inclusive of home care workers, and it also includes nursing home workers and people who are working in assisted living facilities and so on. The home care workforce is the workforce that's going to be directly affected by this rule change. And that workforce is over 2 million workers. And it's people who work inside of other people's homes, supporting their ability to live independently in their homes and communities and rather than going to facilities and nursing homes.
So you're going to be in Baltimore Thursday night speaking at the Pratt. I don't know what time that is. I don't have that in front of me. Perhaps you do know what time you're going to be speaking at the Pratt. What is your message?
My message is one about the dignity of all work and the fact that, I mean, right now, we are, as a country, undergoing a tremendous demographic shift, not only in terms of race and immigration, but also in terms of generation. The baby boom generation is starting to reach retirement age at a rate of a person every 8 seconds. 10,000 people per day turn 65 in America. And so what that means is that, and people are living longer than ever. People my grandmother's age, 85 and older, are the fastest growing age group in the country. And so we're going to need more care and support for working families than we've ever needed before. But we've so undervalued the caregiving workforce that we can hardly sustain the workers who are in the workforce today. We are, the way that we undervalue care work and domestic work today means that the people who we count on to care for our loved ones can't take care of their own doing this work. And so the message really is looking at how we are all connected to this workforce that works inside of what some call the care economy, the work that goes into supporting families and truly making everything else possible in our economy. How do we revalue them for the 21st century such that we can really support working families today to get the family care support that they need, as well as take care of our caregivers.
Hey, Jin Poo, I really appreciate your joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Jin Poo is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She will be speaking along with Gustavo Torres of Casa de Maryland at the Central Branch of the Inuprat Free Library, 7 p.m. on Thursday evening, part of the Open Society Institute's Talking About Race series. That's it for us today. I do want to say we will also post on our midday website the names of all seven Democrats and, for that matter, the Republicans who have filed to run in the primary for U.S. Senate next April's primary. Stay tuned for Here and Now and join midday tomorrow. We're going to debrief, talk about that first Democratic presidential debate that's happening tonight. Stay with us tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us today.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.